Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. This afternoon's topic is a courthouse staff's oral argument teleforum on United States Patent and Trademark Office versus Booking.com. This case was argued this morning and was actually the first case in history to have its oral argument televised live on C-SPAN. My name is Michael Wallen, and I'm the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we're fortunate to have with us Arthur Gallwitzer III, who is a partner at Michael Best & Friedrich. We also have Svi Rosen, who is an adjunct professor of law at Southern Illinois University School of Law. After our speakers have their opening remarks, we will then move to an audience Q&A. Thank you both for sharing with us today, and Arthur, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us. It was interesting to listen to a live audio simulcast of an oral argument this morning. It was a little bit of history in the making for Supreme Court nerds. I'll give you a little bit of procedural background before we kick this off. The Booking.com sought to register the term booking.com as a trademark. And as one might expect, I think trademark practitioners are not surprised to hear, the examiner at the trademark office said no. Booking.com took the next step and went to the TTAB, where the answer was also, unsurprisingly, no. Booking.com then took the matter to a federal district court in the Eastern District of Virginia rather than appealing, and it did so because it I can only guess as to why, but it seems as though it wanted to bolster the record, present a survey in support of its position, which it did, and ultimately convinced the district court that Booking.com was registerable, that it was descriptive and not generic, and that the survey demonstrated that it had a requisite distinctiveness. At that point, the trademark office of the U.S. government appealed to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Fourth Circuit affirmed the district court's ruling on a number of fronts. And that led us to today's oral argument, where the Supreme Court certified the question, is there a per se rule that you cannot register as a trademark a phrase like booking, or a term like booking, it's generic, in conjunction with a top-level domain like .com? So that was the question for the court this morning, and we heard oral argument. And with that, I will hand this over to Zivi to give some background on the Supreme Court's precedents and how we got here today.
Thanks, Art. So this case is kind of interesting to those of us who get nerdy about Supreme Court history, because it really involves partially a question of whether we should still be following an 1888 case, usually called the Goodyear case. So the full title of that case is the Goodyear India Rubber Glove Manufacturing Company versus Goodyear Rubber Company. And this comes from a really different time in how trademarks worked in America. The Goodyear case was decided 9 years after the Supreme Court had held the entire trademark code unconstitutional in 1879, the trademark cases. And there actually were still a lot of doubts about whether federal trademark law was even constitutional. In fact, the Goodyear case only started 3 years after the trademark cases. And this case comes from a time that's very different from now in terms of how trademarks were regulated by the law. Us trademark lawyers are usually seeing sort of five possible types of trademarks. You can have a generic mark, which is really a good that describes a product, rather descriptive of a type of product and not where it's from. A descriptive mark, which describes a product but can also indicate source. A suggestive mark, which suggests what product is, but also is descriptive of source inherently, and then arbitrary or fanciful marks, which are inherently descriptive of source. That's how it is now. Back in 1888, you couldn't get a trademark for descriptive marks at all. Federal trademark law only recognized inherently distinctive marks. And As a result, what the case was actually about was the Goodyear rubber patent was in 1847, and the rubber glove manufacturing company had been a patent licensee back in the day and wanted to branch out, and they basically tried to copy the name of the main Goodyear rubber company. And the main Goodyear rubber company sued and eventually tried to get them to enjoin them from changing their corporate name to the Goodyear rubber manufacturing company. And so it's actually technically not a trademark case at all. It's a case about what was called then unfair trading, now called unfair competition. But the court did have some language in there that's really important. And this is 1888, it's a Justice Field opinion, where he said that names that are descriptive of a class of goods cannot be exclusively appropriated by anyone. And the addition of word company only indicates that it's basically that a company has been formed. So if you can't have a monopoly on the word wine for wine. And if you, and in his language, if you call yourself a wine company, it doesn't do anything for you. And that language in the Goodyear case is essentially what's at issue today. Everyone agrees you can't trademark booking, but the question is, can you then trademark booking.com? And so the Goodyear case has remained the law for a long time, even though the trademark law has changed dramatically. The Lanham Act allowed you to trademark descriptive marks, which is a huge shift from where the law was under the Goodyear case, provided you can show they've acquired what we used to call a secondary meaning, and now we call acquired distinctiveness. And now there have been a couple of more recent cases. There was some discussion of a Kellogg case. A Kellogg case is about whether or not shredded wheat is generic for what we call shredded wheat, and the Supreme Court said it was. And in 1982, the Ninth Circuit canceled the Monopoly trademark. That was for Monopoly the game, and they said that it was descriptive of a product and not of a producer, and therefore it was generic for the game. And in response, Congress changed the law and said, and this is 84 revision to the trademark law, that when looking at cancellation of a mark, you have to look at whether or not the primary significance of a mark to consumers is to indicate for product or a producer. And if a primary significance is to indicate for producer, then it can still be a valid trademark. And so with that, I'm going to hand it back over to Art, and we'll sort of have a back and forth a little bit about the argument.
Sure. Well, the court picked up right away with the Goodyear decision, and maybe I should even explain how the court did this morning for a second, since there was no live oral argument. I mean, the litigants weren't there. The Chief Justice started, and as far as I could tell, they just had prearranged or questioned by seniority, or he had some cue from his colleagues as to when they were ready. So we just started with Chief Justice Roberts and went down the line, and he started right away with Goodyear and whether or not Goodyear was good law in light of both its age and the fact that it predates passage of the Lanham Act, which, as we know, is our main body of our trademark law today. And that leads to Goodyear, and I think most of the court was skeptical of Goodyear to some degree because of both the length of time, because the Lanham Act it came after Goodyear, and simply because the dot-com world is not new to us anymore, but new relative to the Goodyear decision. And that discussion seems to reflect, I think, something that's been going on in the law for two decades now or more, which is, does the internet change everything, or can we just look back at our fundamental principles and extrapolate them, scale them, as the tech people would say, to the internet? So in questioning Goodyear, a number of the justices asked, well, how do we decide? How does the trademark office decide what is registerable and what isn't? And the booking.com attorney focused on the primary significance test, and as she did, or as Booking, her client, did in this case, they used a survey to demonstrate to a district court that in the eyes of the consumer, the primary significance of Booking.com was to identify source as opposed to a genus or a category of goods. The government seemed to vary between there being a per se, you know, sticking with the per se rule that there can be no registration or hardly ever have any registration for a term like booking added on to a top level domain, and maybe allowing for very rare exceptions. I think Justice Kagan came out and said, you know, if per se is a bridge too far, I think that was her phrase, what's the test? And in her final reply argument, the government attorney said, well, it's primary significance with Goodyear guardrails. And you know, I'll just say a couple more words on this and turn it back over to Zivi. How this plays out in the real world, you know, it seemed to be on the forefront of everyone's minds. And the Booking.com attorney made the point that, look, the Patent and Trademark Office has been dealing with this now for 20 years. They've got it. And she kept citing her brief and her appendix showing the numerous attempted and failed registrations of .coms. I think the undercurrent is, but if we lose the Goodyear guardrail, or we don't have something that is darn close to a per se test, does that change over time? Does the Trademark Office start allowing all these registrations? Or do, even if the Trademark Office says no, do well-funded litigants take their cases to the district court like Bookings.com did, get a survey, and use that survey to survive the primary significance test and get their mark? And in fact, I don't know if I can remember exactly which justice it was, but someone pointed out, won't trademark registration then become just another domain name registry? And I think that's the slippery slope that a number of the justices were concerned about, and certainly the government doesn't want to risk going that direction.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, so just to play devil's advocate for a minute, I mean, I'd imagine that a lot of the why would it be so terrible if we PTO is a domain registry to a degree? I mean, I assume there's a lot of domains there already, even if it's not. And we talked about all the ones that are generic, but I'm sure there's tons of trademarks that are at the PTO, where if you can get a trademark for the underlying word, there's no reason you shouldn't be able to get a trademark for .com of it as well. And so why would it be so terrible?
Well, I don't think the government would have disagreed with that. In fact, I think that question was raised. It's not – the government wasn't arguing that any – that .coms per se aren't registerable. It's a generic term like booking that is not turned into a registerable mark simply by tacking on a top-level domain. So the government gave examples of a number of, I think she cited her own brief, where there's a number of registered marks involving, you know, just more distinctive names standing alone. And the issue, like Goodyear, is simply adding company or Inc. or here .com isn't enough. And it was Justice Kavanaugh who mentioned the Trademark Office turning into just another domain name registry. And so to answer your question, the first part is the government, there's a distinction between saying nothing with .com can be registered and saying that .com, a narrower point, which is .com doesn't turn a generic term into a registerable mark. But the policy side of this also is if you, and I think Bookings.com takes your position, right? That what's the harm? There's other checks and balances out there. We, you know, weak, these marks might be weak. A party might be reluctant to litigate them. There may be fair use defenses for descriptive use of a registered mark. And a number of the justices seemed concerned that that's not a great set of checks and balances. If you let everyone register, if you say this, the trademark registration is almost a supplemental domain name registry, litigation is expensive. And does it, if litigation is the only check and balance, does that favor large companies, well-funded registrants, who then, with the threat of litigation, even if they have a weak case, will chill competition by scaring away those who were second to the marketplace? And concern about chilling, overcrowding or crowding out, monopolization and chilling seem to be on the minds of, I'd say, almost every one of the justices to some degree.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, of course, and then you get into questions about fee shifting and exceptional cases and all that. And I think it's interesting because, in theory, fair use should be a pretty good guardrail on this, in that it's, fair use in trademark law basically looks at whether your use of a mark is either a non-trademark use, in other words, you're not using it to identify the source of goods, or you're using it to identify goods properly as someone else's. And in theory, assuming that the person who has the trademark for a domain actually has the domain, and I imagine it'll cause all sorts of problems if they didn't. In theory, that would be a guardrail. But it is an interesting point as to how, the cost of litigation, attorney's fees work with that. And I don't think we have a clear answer there.
I can anecdotally, as a practicing litigator, we often have clients who say, not only do I want to win, I want the other side to pay my fees. And we often are in the position of explaining the American rule and how even in trademark cases and patent cases, the threat of attorney fees is not a very strong one. It'd be interesting to do a study and find the empirical data, but anecdotally, I don't feel like it's very strong. And so on the flip side, the cost of hiring a law firm and a lawyer to defend against that infringement case is enough where there's a real danger that you deter competition. And in fact, I think Justice Gorsuch hinted at that in one of his questions, and I think the government possibly could have done even more with that point. But it was on the minds of several of the justices.
Also, this was a really interesting argument, not least it's the first argument ever live streamed, but one of the very few cases where Justice Thomas has spoken. I actually don't know when the last time was. I'm sure someone knows exactly. But one of his questions was one that I think is sort of lurking here, that if generic.com, is not okay, why is 1-800-GENERIC okay? And I thought the government sort of hemmed and hawed and said, well, Federal Circuit allows it, but we're not sure. And it's sort of an interesting question that, that's pretty well established by now, I feel. I think you probably have a lot of trademarks with a 1-800 or, 1-866 prefix. And I'm curious, how this decision intersects with that.
Yeah, I agree with you. I didn't feel like the government had a great answer. It was a good question, and the government didn't seem to have a strong answer. I couldn't tell if Justice Thomas had an answer to his own question in mind, and the government missed an opportunity to sort of to drive that home, because he posed, like most of the justices, but he turned around and posed questions right back at the Booking.com attorney when it was her turn and questioned her reliance on the primary significance test. So I'm not sure where he was going with that, but I agree. The government didn't have a strong answer. I think the practical answer, and maybe this is why, maybe what the government wanted to say, or maybe anyone on the listening here might be thinking as well, is an 800 number as crucial to a business's success as their internet address? And it's sitting here in the year 2020. It's probably hard for some of us to remember what commerce was like in the early 90s and before. And there's probably plenty of people who weren't even adults at that time. I'm old enough to remember it, but I'm having a hard time imagining how critical that 800 number was. Because today, I think you sit and think, well, there's no way that's as limiting or gives someone as much of a monopoly or as much of a competitive advantage as having both the .com domain and then the trademark rights to try to exclude anyone who's even confusingly similar. So that my sense is that's the answer the government wanted to give and just didn't have firm footing to give it. I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, well, it's kind of funny because I teach the 555-1212 case every year in trademark law. Every time, not a single student had any idea what 555-1212 ever was for directory assistance. That's just what it is.
It reminds me of a tweet I saw the other day where someone was joking that nobody remembers that you used to be able to call a phone number to get the correct time.
Yeah. That's right. Which is sort of a thing, though, of course. And really, some mentioned in the briefings, if a .com is increasingly less relevant and the name on social media becomes more important, and perhaps having booking on Twitter is more important than having booking.com. Probably not yet, but it feels like it's moving in that direction.
It might, or on Facebook. And if so, you don't care about the booking.com, you care about excluding anyone confusingly similar to booking. But doesn't that support the government's case, as I think about this aloud? If booking.com is allowed to register, and I have a business just called booking, you'd never be able to register that in the past. You'd assuredly be rejected as generic. And I want to promote my business on Facebook, and booking.com comes along and sues me or sends me a cease and desist letter because it never could have registered booking either, but it got to registration because of the .com suffix, which, as we're suggesting, maybe down the road doesn't even matter. And yet it's going to exclude my business from using my name on my business's chosen name on Facebook. So that could cut in the government's favor if the transition to other forms of social media is a primary driver.
Yeah, because, of course, in a way, a blue check is on Twitter or verified is very different from trademark registration. But you probably can't enforce that if someone tries to squat you or push you out on these platforms if you've chosen a generic name like this. Of course, unless...
But if you get it registered...
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So a couple other things that jumped out at me, the booking, there's a line of questions that came from the booking.com's attorneys focus on how the PTO is doing a good job with this. We don't need a per se rule, she seemed to be saying. We don't need Goodyear. Primary significance test works. It's all good. Let's just go forward, seemed to be what she was saying. In fact, she was asked a couple times about crowding out, and I was taken aback because at one point she said the concept of crowding out was silly. And when several of the justices had used that phrase, but saying it's silly seems to presuppose that nothing changes if booking.com wins the case, which is, I think, the scenario she was trying to paint. And I'm not so sure that's true. And it seems like some of the justices may also have had concerns because, again, the government picked up on this that said, well, it's primary significance with Goodyear guardrails. If we take the guardrails away, does the PTO handle things differently? Does the internal guidance change? Do examiners approve more things? Or do well-funded applicants just take it to, when they really want it, take it to the district court, get the Teflon survey, and convince a district court that they can get their registration? Now, the bookings.com attorney said, well, in fact, the justices made fun of the survey at one point, but that said that even though 70-some% of people recognize bookings.com as a source as opposed to a category, even 30% were mistakenly believed that, I think it was washingmachines.com was a source. And the justices, while the bookings.com gave a bit of an explanation of how a Teflon survey works, the justices said, I think their point was, well, there's a bias, there is an inherent bias in these surveys when dealing with the internet, that consumers are sophisticated enough to understand that if you have a .com domain name, you're a business, and these surveys are going to be biased. And again, the bookings.com attorney pushed back. She said that there's experts in the field, academic pieces that suggest that's not true, but the justices seem concerned, and all this plays into this big picture of where does the world go, right? If more and more, without the guardrails, do we go down essentially a slippery slope again towards being a domain name registry instead of a trademark office?
Yeah, so I think that it's interesting because I feel like I'm blanking on the case, but there's a paper by Barton Beeb and Gene Frommer that was in a Harvard Law Review, I believe, called "Are We Running Out of Trademarks? An Empirical Study of Trademark Depletion and Congestion," where they go into, this concern, and they say, well, there's some concern that we are actually running out of trademarks now. And that's what some of the justices seem to be echoing. And I feel like you've seen that argument before. I forget the case, but I recall it being mentioned. And I think they're concerned about it, even if PTO isn't. even if booking isn't. But I do think that there is a concern for minds. I think that that article will be mentioned and such. I think that I just thought the exchange between the lawyer for booking and Justice Gorsuch was really interesting. It got a little testy at times, it felt, talking about the Teflon survey and, you know, booking was holding it out as this gold standard and, pretty much is, I guess, you know, and how these things are done. But the court was sort of much more skeptical of the methodology, and which could be interesting down the road. My suspicion is, I don't think Goodyear is good. Go ahead. I'll let you respond to that.
Let me respond to that and then maybe let you conclude and we can, if we're ready for questions. But it did get a little bit testy. I thought, along with referring to crowding out as being silly, and she was a little short with the justices as a whole. She implied, I thought, that they didn't appreciate the science behind the survey. But then she made the substantive argument that consumers will focus on the detail when the marks are similar. She took this sort of as an a priori truth that when you have similar marks, consumers inherently hone in on the details. And maybe that's right, but her client is booking, it's booking.com. If someone comes along and wants to be bookings with an S.com, is how in the real world is her client that comfortable with that? Is their client really that sure that the consumers are going to know the difference between booking and bookings? And if they are, maybe they are at first. Maybe the thought is, hey, we were the first mover, we're the big player in the market. Who cares about this new bookings.com? We won't sue them with our federally registered mark because it's going to be, our mark is weak, our protection's thin, we'll leave it alone. Okay, but let's say bookings.com starts to beat them in the marketplace, right? Let's say bookings.com has a better website, a better algorithms, a better model, and then bookings.com goes to register. Is booking still so content with that? Are they going to oppose the registration? Are they happy to rely on this supposed consumer attention to details? Yeah. So that struck me as an interesting argument, and I'm not sure. I mean, I understand why she made it, but I think the justices are not so convinced.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Let's be honest. If booking was my client or yours, and we saw a new registration for a filing for bookings.com, would you file an opposition?
I suspect they would.
Yeah, I would too. And I think that's one. That's, you know, and everyone's afraid of. Okay, fine. You know, we actually kind of recognize that Booking.com actually has acquired distinctiveness and is, you know, functioning as a mark even if it's not registered. But is it? Where does this take us? And I don't know the answer to that either. You know, there's sort of this thing we do with a lot of 19th century decisions, which is we sort of rip them out of context and we sort of use a paragraph as sort of the holding. It's sort of a reimagining, but it kind of works well for Goodyear, because that one paragraph of Justice Field's opinion where he talks about the, you know, adding company and doesn't change it, he's talking about something actually very different from modern law, but it's not – it fits surprisingly well into a discussion, even though it's not really, even though if you actually were half a time, you would sort of say, what the heck are you talking about this case? Well, beyond the fact that the internet would be a little confusing. And I mean, I don't know, I kind of suspect there's going to be some attempt to keep some of Goodyear, but to also maybe be a little wary of an ipso facto rule. I'm not positive how that's going to work.
Well, that takes us back to, you know, Justice Kagan's question to the government. You know, if a per se rule is a bridge too far, what guidance can you give us? She asked the government, what guidance can you give us? Wait, if we're going to put some barrier, she didn't, now I'm using my words and not hers, but it sounded like she's saying, if we're going to put some guardrails in our opinion, what are they? And the government focused on the very rare exception. The example she used was tennis.net, right, where the top-level domain name also has a double meaning in connection with the more generic term tennis. Government conceded that's the rare exception. I'm not sure that gave Justice Kagan the guidance she was looking for, hoping to get, but it felt like they were all grasping for something skeptical of Goodyear, but something more than a free-for-all where anyone who wants to get a survey improved pass the primary significance test gets a registration.
Yeah, no, and it's funny because, of course, the question presented is about the ipso facto rule. And I suspect that it's not going to survive, but the heart of it might survive even if it literally doesn't. But probably a good time to take some questions. And if people don't have questions, I have a few in the chamber as well.
Good afternoon. Stephen Casey from Austin, Texas. Thank you so much to the panel for the discussion. This affects me not only in a theoretical sense, very practical sense. I went to register a trademark of a term that's actually a product and became our company name that we derived it from. And there's a car company that uses a couple of those letters in their car name. And their process, I think, what you are talking about the chilling effect of big companies. I went on the PTO website and looked at all the letters they've sent out and all the companies they've challenged on anything that they've registered. And it is very much a challenge comes up and it's a small company and they either never respond and there's a default or, they reach some sort of compromise, but they use their power of leverage to almost trademark an entire word. The car company is Audi, Motor Group. And they've anything that has AUDI, no matter what the rest of the word is, it can be like a 17 letter word that starts with AUDI. And they basically said that those four letters are their purview and domain, no matter what. And so I think there needs to be some pretty clear guidelines saying that you can't get the world, and you own those four letters for the rest of the time. I think consumers are intelligent. And they'll be able to determine what's going on. I'd like to get your perspective, though, on a little bit more about that, the idea of generics that have a specific, they take on a different meaning.
Well, I'll jump in. I mean, so the problem, oftentimes in trademark law, the boundaries are really amorphous between a generic and descriptive term. And that can be really tricky. So American Airlines, for instance, is an American airline, but it's also the company American Airlines. It's sort of a classic example of a descriptive trademark. How much protection does that give you compared to other marks that have a word? Like if you would, like, let's say you have an airline, United American Airlines, for instance, would that violate trademark for American Airlines, and whereas airline is just a generic term, and so you couldn't protect airline, but you could protect American Airlines, providing you show that the public recognized it as a trademark. And one concern, I think, of the argument was if we're going to allow some generic marks in, we add .com, you already have examiners who are really trying to split metaphysical hairs to figure out if something is generic or descriptive, and you're just making their job much harder and making it much harder, and that in turn goes to marketplace because you suddenly have even more marks that are really on the edge of generic and potentially have a very wide scope.
I'll weigh in. My mind took me in a slightly different place in response to your question, and that is I think the bookings.com attorney would say in response to your question that that's a perfect example. Your Audi example is a perfect example of where the confusion test saves the day, right? She'd say that if Audi, the term Audi is not, at least unless it has, well, I'm not sure the foreign language meaning of it, but at least in English, I don't think anyone would argue it's generic. But if Audi has its registration, it's presumably in the classes relating to automobiles, and someone opens up a bar or restaurant here, and I'm in Austin where you are, it opens up a bar and restaurant and calls it Audi Eats. I don't know that Audi, the automotive company, gets very far in suing Audi Eats for trademark infringement. So, that's what the bookings.com attorney would say. And in this instance, I might agree with her, right? It's Audi's and it's probably registerable as far as I can tell on its own. But the person down the street that has Audi Eats as their bar, I'm not sure there's the channels of trade. Everything is so different. There's probably no confusion. your fear is warranted. I mean, as a litigator, it's if you have a small client who gets that cease and desist letter, they're thinking, well, how the heck am I going to have the money to defend this? So that's a concern with our legal system as a whole. As applied to this case, though, you know, it's not Audi, right? It's the that four letter here. It's what, six, seven letters booking. Is generic on its own, and to say that when I tack .com onto it, don't worry about it. I'm not going to sue everybody because my mark's weak. That really scares me. That scares me more than the Audi, suing Audi Eats example, because now you're making it so much easier to, as far as it seems like, you're making it easier to register lots of different things, unless both Zivi and I are right in the court. Fashions an opinion here that maintains the Goodyear guardrails, whether it expressly does so or not.
All right. We'll now move to our next question.
Yes, Tim Harker, Potomac. Why did the court grant cert in this case? And the fact that it granted cert, does that give you any indication of how they're likely to rule? And then thirdly, how many questions did Justice Thomas ask?
Zivi, I'll go first on this one and then quickly hand it off. I suspect the granted cert, I can't know for sure, but I suspect the granted cert, because remember the bookings won in the district court and in the Fourth Circuit. So it could be a sign that the court didn't agree with where the Fourth Circuit was going to take us here. And on the number of questions, it was several of both sides.
Yeah, and I think that might, be more of all he's asked on the bench otherwise. I'm not positive. Certainly in the past decade. I don't know. I mean, it's always dangerous, frankly, to read too much into both a cert grant and, frankly, into an argument. I mean, you never know why four judges, it could be the judges, it could be the clerks. There's so many reasons why they could have granted cert. I mean, maybe someone really wanted it, never justice. You just don't know. I wouldn't read too much into it necessarily, but I do agree if you want to, that's probably the best read. And likewise, arguments. I mean, I've first few times that I went to Supreme Court, I really thought I knew how it would go. And I've been wrong enough times now to say, don't think you know how it's going to go. Oftentimes the justices are really testing out arguments to sort of actually fix up the direction we're going in, which is the opposite, instead of to go in the direction. Other times we're just showing our hand. You just don't know. So I've stopped reading too much into this.
Yeah, Zivi, I might add that this format where the justices asked questions in seniority order, so it was less conversational, probably makes it even harder to read the tea leaves, right? Because, I mean, if Kavanaugh, there were a couple times where Kavanaugh followed Gorsuch or Gorsuch followed Kagan, and they were able to pick up on the point that was being discussed by the preceding justice. That happened organically. For the most part, it felt like they were showing less of their hand because they didn't get that chance to sort of argue with each other via the attorney at the podium. If you've been there more than I have, I don't know, does that sound plausible to you?
You're absolutely right. And I think a lot of justices, and frankly, the attorneys, didn't quite know what to make of this new format. And I think Nina Totenberg had a comment, I think she was serious, so I'm taking it as partially a joke, that they're using this case about an area of law that only the nerds care about to sort of do a dry run for more politicized cases. Because it was a very different environment for justices. How do you let someone answer a question when you have this very, very regimented sort of structure, and where the questions have often been prepared in advance? And also, I don't know if you're going to get a lot of commentary, but asking a question seriatim, I mean, that was a practice, as I understand it, that was abolished by Justice Marshall in 1800. It's sort of funny that Court by Zoom, or whatever the actual platform is, not to genericize Zoom, is coming back.
Lee and Arthur, I'll toss it back over to you for anything else you'd like to discuss.
Yeah, so I actually have one that I find interesting. It wasn't discussed, but I think it's interesting for commentary, and that is, what's the relevant, is .com magical here? And I was thinking of two things here. There. One is, for a while, Booking.com had a commercial campaign, which was Booking.com, Booking.yeah. And they did not own booking.yeah. But if they did, and if that was a generic top-level domain, could they, in fact, get a trademark in booking.yeah? And then the other side, booking.com has, in fact, received a generic top-level domain for .booking. Can they get a trademark registration for that?
And I hope you aren't throwing those to me for an answer, because I don't know. I mean, you know, you make an interesting point about the shift away from .com, .org, .net, right? Where you could have a top level domain where that suffix is a greater variety. Does that, as we maybe talk this through, does that support the booking.com position, because the monopoly power isn't as great and I think it's more than just making those top level domains available, but having them gain consumer acceptance, right? Because those have been around for a while, but it seems like most people still promote or most consumers think of things in terms of .gov, .org, .com, .net. But if it's booking.booking or booking.hotels, now does it start to sound more like the advertising or the marketing that occurs in the brick and mortar world? And maybe the government would even agree. Maybe that's their point, is when they say that it's a per se rule, you can't have a generic like booking, tack on .com and then magically have the whole be greater than the sum of the parts. Maybe even the government and the trademark office would say, well, when it's something other than .com, when it's something where the suffix is more distinctive, it's a whole new ballgame.
Of course, you said booking.hotels. Booking.com also owns .hotels. It's just according to Wikipedia, but that's what it says. My intuition is that you might be able to get booking.yeah, but not booking.com. And I think that suggests generally, who knows how court will rule, but I do have an intuition there is a difference between booking.com and booking.yeah.
But booking.yeah sounds almost suggestive or fanciful at that point, right? You start tacking things on that don't have a descriptive or generic nature. Now, it is trademark law that you look at the proposed mark in its entirety, right? You look at the whole. And if that suffix adds change, if the whole has a completely different consumer perception, I don't know that the government may even concede that.
Yeah, no, but of course that is not a booking.com domain.yeah. It's a available to more people. But yeah, I do think there is I imagine a court will have to explore this some more. I don't think that it's an obvious answer right now, but I think it does suggest why the issue is. There's a great line from Justice Story, I think, in one of the very early copyright cases, that in IP, more than any other area of law, the law approach is metaphysical. And I think that's definitely the case here.
All right. Still no other questions in the queue. So I think we've exhausted our audience of questions for the day. Did either of you have anything else you'd like to discuss or any closing remarks?
Yeah, I'm fine. Thank you for letting us do this. I think it was a unique opportunity to do one of these teleforums on the first ever live audio simulcast. That makes it kind of fun.
It's fun to be part of a historic moment.
All right. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd like to thank both of our speakers and experts for the benefit of their valuable expertise and time today. And we welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.